Hello.
Hey!
Hi,
Hello.
guys.
Wow. It's a
This feels so
reunion.
good.
Is this gonna be like a sequel no one wanted? Like Independence Day Resurgence? Or, like, really? Again?
No, I'm counting on you guys because I barely see movies anymore, so I need you to inform me about the world.
Well, welcome back, everyone.
Thanks. Thank
I'm
you. Yeah.
Nathaniel with the Film Experience, and I'm here with Katie Rich,
Hi.
who is a new mother.
Yeah, I have a companion with me who is being very quiet right now, but may pipe up. And he watched 13th with me yesterday, so he's pretty informed.
Wow. Okay. He's awake and woke.
Hey.
And Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
Hello.
And Joe Reed from Decider.
I am.
Joe, you wrote something on Decider the other day that I bookmarked, and I still forgot to read it, but I'm like dying to read it.
Oh no, what was it?
The in
Yeah.
and out piece.
What?
Oh,
I
maybe.
like the in and out piece.
Thank you.
Oh, I missed that one. That's
Is that
in the
awesome?
way, wait, what's it called? The way we queer? What was it?
Gay We Were.
I love
The
that. The
Gay We
gay we
Were.
were, of course, God.
Yes.
Although the way we queer is like would be an interesting
Doesn't make
in
any sense.
like advice column, like instruction, like something like that. That could work. Let's not throw that baby out with the bathwater.
All
That
right, you hang on to that.
it was the hunt for the most thankless role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
Ah.
Speaking of thankless roles, guess what I saw last night?
What?
Sully.
Oh God, sorry.
Oh. Did you go see it in theaters with a bunch of dads?
I went and saw it in theaters. It was mostly like couples who were not participating in Halloween last night.
Or were they, and you just couldn't tell because they were in Sully cosplay and dressed like very normal
Oh,
people.
was sort of like a blue-gray filter so that none of them would stand out.
Right, exactly.
So who's the thankless role in Sully? Aaron Eckhart
Oh,
or are we talking Tom Hanks?
goodness, the lovely Laura Linney.
Oh, of course, wife on the phone.
And it's not just a wife on a phone. It's like even her dialogue repeats over and over again.
Yeah, it's
Like,
really
I'm
bad.
worried about you. I love you.
Also, for as heroic as Sully is, he is not heroic when it comes to telephone manners, because he will just hang up on someone without being like goodbye, or he's not a good phone guy. He's more of a good in-person guy.
Is Laura Linney's role better or worse than Catherine Keener and Captain Phillips in the exact same role?
Like she's less egregious, but
She
yeah.
probably had to work more for it, so
Oh
maybe
yeah, so that's more of a shame.
It's a real race to the bottom.
Although she could have still filmed it all in one day.
That's true. But Catherine Keener could have filmed that all in like a coffee break. So
And I
Catherine
saw the
Keener
trailer
probably went
like
home and like went back to bed for that and still got a whole day out of that. So
So, you guys have all seen Sully?
Did you like
yes.
anything about
I
it?
have not seen Sully.
Have you seen
Charlie has.
Katie, have you only seen things that are available to stream since
No,
the
because I
newborn?
saw Moonlight. That was a big accomplishment. I got out, I did a
Ooh.
daytime screening of Moonlight during work. But otherwise, yes, it's pretty much only things that are streaming. And I'm starting to get some screeners, so my catch-up potential has increased. But over the summer, when I was on maternity leave, I saw a lot of stuff on iTunes that I can talk about eventually.
Okay.
But yeah, so I've heard some like naysayers being like, "No, Sully's pretty good." So set me straight, Nathaniel.
I mean, you all know my general feelings about Clint Eastwood. So as that goes, I thought it was fine. Like it was pleasant. I thought a little bit about that. I don't know if any of you have seen La La Land, but there's one of the main themes of La La Land is that if you're passionate about something, it will transfer to other people. Like other people will care about it because you're passionate about it.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt that a little bit watching Sully. I'm like, there's not really enough material here for a whole movie, but I'm engaged in a way I'm not usually with Clint Eastwood movies. Like, he's really obsessed with this, plane landing. But it still felt slight to me.
I don't even know if he was obsessed with the plane land. I mean, like those scenes are the scenes that are the most interesting in the movie, and that they keep going back to them is what sort of kept me into the movie. But I feel like he's also obsessed with this idea of heroes being properly credited as such, which is like kind of the plot driver of that movie. And it's really hard to get on board with, A, when you know the story and you know that they're only making a movie about this guy because he is properly credited as a hero. Charlie, I agree with you.
you can hear that.
but also just the fact that like so much of that movie is them in, you know, various sort of hotel conference rooms making the strenuous case that like, no, this is exactly as heroic as people are saying it is, and how dare you say it's not. And the fact that the I can't remember the acronym for whatever the organization is that's looking into it, is painted with such sort of villainous broad strokes, where like Mike O'Malley is just foaming at the mouth through most of the scenes.
And isn't that all basically made up? Like, there was not nearly the kind of investigation that the movie shows.
I can't imagine it would have been that, at least not that tone. Like, if there was an investigation.
It was a compulsory investigation that they had to do, but it did not involve the Inquisition.
Yeah. And then poor Anna Gunn has to play this, like, you know, at first stern, you know, woman who has her heart changed, you know, her heart grew to 3 sizes the day of the final thing. And then the whole thing ends on this, like, and people have written about this, like, this incredibly sitcomish, like, nearly freeze-frame-worthy, like, final joke that, like, that's the last thing in the movie is Aaron Eckhart making this, like, crack.
I mean, I would have liked it more if it had, you know, frozen the frame right there. Because,
well,
like, the fade-outs always, the fade-outs in Eastwood movies, I don't know, I'm like, really? It's like, it just seems so, like, oh.
This one felt particularly...
But that's just because when it fades out, you know you're about to hear some, like, twinkly piano that Clint Eastwood put together while Jenny filmed her scene.
So I found this one particularly, I don't know, embarrassing. Something. There was something about it where I was just like, oh my god, like, this was above and beyond.
I haven't been able to get Amy Nicholson's review out of my head, where she was just basically like, this is a movie about how a white man needs to be considered more heroic and how we're worried that white men aren't being getting there too. And that, like, that alone has kind of kept me from seeing it.
Oh, for those who were confused earlier when Joe said, Charlie, I agree with you, Charlie is Katie's baby.
Yes, and he's talking up a storm. I'm trying to to do both at the same time.
Get him near the mic so we can hear.
So he can hear his thoughts.
Yeah.
You could have just said he's the 10-foot rabbit that Joe sometimes talks to. And that would have been
also true. Yes.
Yeah.
I named the baby after the 10-foot rabbit.
That's sweet. I don't know. I liked Sully a little bit more, but mostly because, like, Sully himself seems genuinely spooked by what he did. And even when he's getting exonerated, he's not at all convinced, seemingly. Like, he gets some moral authority going in front of the big bad NTSB, but I liked that he was really freaked out by what I thought the movie was going to sell to us as kind of like pure triumph. And in even the, like, Aaron Eckhart character's willingness to just take for granted that this is all a kangaroo court and even kind of joke about it up to the last scene, kind of contrasted with me that Sully just seems to be bottoming out as the movie sort of unfolds until about the last 10 minutes. And I like that about it. Mm-hmm. It was an idea I'd never had about that character.
I was a little thrown by Aaron Eckhart just because when he said he didn't, this just, you know, shows my internal biases. When he said he didn't drink and had never had a drink, I was like, oh, it's a Mormon character. but that's because I was at BYU and so was Aaron Eckhart. So that threw me because all of a sudden he started, you know, using profanity and I was like, wait a minute.
That's not a Mormon.
I call bullshit.
So am I going to go into a rage stroke when Tom Hanks gets an Oscar nomination for this and not for Captain Phillips and
right?
There's no justice in the world?
I was thinking that too.
I mean, it's a pretty thin year this year, so it's probably more likely that
I think if he is nominated this year, they'll view it as for Captain Phillips as well, because there are actually some similarities.
And for Black Jeopardy.
Yes.
Seriously.
And David
Pumpkin. Yeah, he's having quite the autumn, for sure.
Also for Inferno, I think we all think that's a...
well, yes, of course.
Dark Horse.
You have to honor that somewhere.
For that whole series, really. Yeah,
that's right. They'll understand it's really for Angels and Demons.
Yeah.
So shall we talk about Moonlight? Right now.
Yeah, let's talk about Moonlight.
Katie's like, yes, the one movie I saw.
Yeah, I can participate.
And a, like, super freaking good one at that.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's pretty great. Although,
yeah, it's been really nice having the consensus around it. Like, it's a movie I heard about from festivals and then caught, you know, relatively late in the critic cycle. And it's like, oh, yeah, this lives up to the hype. It was a nice feeling.
Can I start with something slightly, like, negative, though, just because, just for kicks, so it's not just,
yeah,
like,
oh, my God, it's great. Yeah, that's the way we queer. Start with something slightly negative.
I am a little freaked out that apparently there weren't really gay people involved in the making of it.
The writer is
just
who wrote
the
story
the
based on his life, right? He adapted the script with Barry Jenkins, didn't he?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
He eventually kind of, like, handed it over to Barry Jenkins, but...
Yeah, that bothered me a little bit when that started coming out, that everybody involved was straight. I was like, wait a minute. But maybe because it feels like such, like, a... hearing, like, a queer voice you have never heard in the movies.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, but... but it's actually not? Or... I don't know. That made me feel a little weird. Anyone else?
I didn't really know that, and I assumed that Barry Jenkins might be gay, but, I mean, it felt so compelling in the moment, and evoked a lot that I don't feel like I get in other movies, that I'm all for it. Way to go, straight guys, if that's what happened.
Yeah, I feel like if this, you know, can be sort of like getting a ball rolling for other voices, then... It's good. I think there's just such a you know, dearth of movies of this kind from anybody that I'm happy to sort of, like, look at the product with this and sort of maybe, you know, keep an eye on the identities of the people making it for the next one. Because I think I just think the fact that this is so good sort of, you know, obviates a lot of those concerns for me.
In interviews that Barry Jenkins has been doing, he's been really careful about the way he describes himself. He's like, I'm in this as an ally. Like, he's not trying to speak for people. He's really threading that needle in a way that suggests he's thought a lot about this and kind of wants to be careful not to sound like he's speaking for gay people while also telling this story. And the fact that, like you were saying, there are so few versions of this out there, and this, like, from, you know, what I can tell, like, it seems to be a pretty accurate version of the story, or at least a compelling one. So it's not like he's kind of stepping in and, like, giving him his version of something, but he's really, like, drawing to the surface a story that is resonating with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it just freaked me out a little bit because of the whole, like, notion of there's been such a welcome, you know, concern about, like, have, you know, directors of color direct movies that are about people of color and so on. And so it's like, right, the identity politics part of it, and have, you know, female directors, like, have more of those, you know, to tell women's stories and things.
Sure.
Not that people can only tell stories about themselves. I think that's a problem that can emerge from all the identity politics, because, you know, some of the great filmmakers regularly tell stories about things they're not involved with at all. Like, Ang Lee is so good at just jumping into any culture,
yeah,
he decides to look at, and... You know,
Ron Howard's not even a Knights Templar, as far as I know.
That you know of. Let's not speak
That's
for...
Right. No. Yeah, caveats. Yeah, I mean, I totally am with you. At the same time, it seems like the real nub of that criticism is typically, you know, all the things that the movie or the text doesn't get by being made from a perspective outside the one that the material presumes. And I will be completely interested if I read anything about what black queer guys from the South think this doesn't hit on the head. But it, mm-hmm, but when there's a case where you feel like, wow, you know, like, this filmmaker, whoever they are, this team, whoever they are, really got inside what they're doing in a way that's resonating as authentic for so many people, and that feels kind of like a success story, even if the pattern's bad. Or worth commenting on, anyway.
No, I agree. It's just something that occurred to me because of all the other stories about representation.
Yeah. I mean, feel free to slap me for ignorance here, but I'm trying to think of, like, American queer directors of color who at least are, you know, working on a level at which a movie like Moonlight would have this kind of prominence. Like, all I can think of is Pedro Almodovar, which is, I'm sure, not the end of it, but it doesn't, it seems like that's a very untapped market of director. Oh, Lee Daniels, of course. He I mean, he's made some interesting films about the Black experience, so he's definitely gotten his voice out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder what Lee Daniels thinks about Moonlight. That would be a really interesting interview.
Yes. I did read Gabby Sidibe talking about it on Twitter.
There you go.
She's obsessed with it.
She can speak for Lee Daniels.
She's his official spokesperson at this point.
So I can also tweak Moonlight a little bit if we want to start there and not just have this be like a rapturous session.
With the understanding that we all loved it.
This is where you have to start with like the nitpicks. But I think I might have told Joe this. It's just so the movie is told in three sections about this one character when he's a child, when he's in high school, and then when he's a grown man. And I thought the middle section in the high school, which is, it's really pivotal for where the story goes, and there's like some very authentic and, you know, heart-wrenching stuff that happens in it, but the way that the plot moves forward in that section in particular, like, felt a little rushed and kind of implausible to me, just for the way that like high school bullies work, and like it kind of sped up like years worth of bullying and feelings into a pretty short time frame, and it jarred me a little bit. But then the kind of magic trick of the movie is that the final section, this, you know, basically this two-hander scene with the adult character, and then this character played by Audrey Holland, is so good that you kind of forget all about it. But the middle part of it definitely still, it clanged for me a little bit. And I've heard, mostly when I've talked to people about this, they're like, yeah, but then I loved it anyway. And that's kind of where I came down anyway. But I have thought about that a good bit.
It's funny, I was talking about this very thing with your Vanity Fair colleague, Richard Lawson, the other night. So this is sort of, I guess, the Vanity Fair...
The party line.
The party line from... from Graydon's folks about this. No, it's I can sort of see that, except I felt like, because the actor who plays Chiron in that middle section, I think, is so, I don't know, his face just like broke my heart like consistently. It just,
yeah,
the sort of the pain that sort of rested on his face that whole time. And I can see where, like, we've seen these sort of like stories of like high school bullying follow these beats before, but like watching it sort of up close the way it was, and I feel like it was filmed in such a, you know, almost like a prescribed kind of claustrophobic kind of way, where like there's no alternate avenues for this kid, and he's just, you know, this is where he's got to be every day, and these are the people he can't avoid. And the fact that within that section is also that scene on the beach, which is like, to
which
me,
is incredible.
The most like, honestly, like, breathtaking part of that entire movie, and where that movie really kind of like breaks free from all sorts of like things. You don't get scenes like that in anything. It's the tone of it and the look of it and the sort of, you know, feeling of it, and me going into that movie without really knowing a whole lot of where the plot goes, I was sort of on the edge of my seat that whole time. Every time they moved, any time, you know, the camera sort of like moved to like a hand or an arm or anything like that, it was honestly riveting. And I felt like in some ways that made that middle section my favorite of the three, even though like there's like so much to be, you know, the fact that like Mahershala Ali's fantastic performance is all in the first one. And then in the, you know, third one, it's, you know, like you said, that sort of like, you know, two-hander that is also riveting in its own way. So
when I was speaking to Charlie the other day, he was regretting that there was no toddler section or baby
That's
section
true.
That he could relate to.
There's really no non-verbal component of the movie. It's you know, you really have to understand language to get this movie. So he'll get there in a couple years.
Yeah.
How about that coup right when you said Mahershala Ali?
Right.
It's true.
That's how we all feel about Mahershala Ali, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with the Vanity Fair party line on this. Like, the middle section's my least favorite, but that is extremely nitpicky, because I thought one of the reasons the movie was so brilliant, and I loved, Nick, what you said about they're the same character, or are they, which was an interesting comment, because it is, you know, you can look at it as sort of like a triptych of similar experiences, if you don't want to take it as literally, you know.
Of, or, I mean, as the consistently most positive member of this podcast, I will just come in with some unqualified enthusiasm as opposed to my colleagues. But just the sense of whether you change so much, you know, from different stages of your life, especially if you're contending with that much pressure, that like, in what sense are you and are you not the same person with like the over the gaps that that movie crosses. Mm-hmm.
I totally agree, which is why what I think is such a strength of it is that it's non-repetitive.
Yeah.
Even though you're getting, you know, similar like pressures and similar like identity crises about who am I really and who can I be and all those things, it really feels like three short films that become one great motion picture.
And
I loved that they were so different, the three sections.
I could not believe when, and I haven't read any of the other press, so maybe they always talk about this, but at the Q&A at the screening that I went to, when Barry Jenkins was saying he didn't let any of the Chirons watch any of the other ones' scenes until the movie was all cut together. Because Trevante Rhodes to me is, I mean, easily one of the best performances of the year so far. And that's the oldest Chiron.
Yeah.
And I was so into like different ways in which like vocally or like inclinations of his head, whatever, there were different ways in which he was calling back to both of the other younger ones so adeptly. And then it turned out he hadn't even seen it.
That's insane. I even wrote in my review that I felt like he alchemized both of the earlier performances.
Completely. Yes.
Wow.
But sometimes people know what they're doing when they're casting, I guess.
Yeah.
Or do you think that's a credit to his direction, too? Like, that he can kind of bring those same things out of them, even if they're not even aware of it?
Totally. Sure. Yep. Gold stars all around. And that Naomi Harris only had 3 days on the movie, and they weren't even in sequence. So she did the character in the first sequence, and then actually the first, and then she did the last scene that she has, and then she did the middle. Boom, wow. Boom, boom. Okay.
Can we talk about sort of how cataclysmically awesome her scene with Mahershala Ali was?
At the drug deal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just oh my god, these two actors together.
Yeah, the whole cast of this movie, I mean, it's like, not that it's not impeccably written and directed, but the performances just give you so much. Like, every time a new triptych starts, you kind of have something whole new to discover in another performer, which is really, it's just a great feeling. It's like you're just unwrapping it, like, repeatedly and seeing something amazing and new.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about Oscars and how hard it is to give Oscars for those kinds of performances?
Well, that's the other thing, is just sort of all of a sudden now everybody's in that same supporting bucket, and it's just like, god damn it, like, it's...
I don't see a way around it, though. Like, it's...
No, I agree with you.
Well, this is why it's good to have the Ensemble Prize, so if SAG does not nominate them, it will be insane.
But it's also why, Joe, it would be good to have The Hague.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing up an old idea of mine, but still, yes.
Wait, the what?
That we need an international cinema court adjudicates these things for everybody. And I mean, even down to, like, you know, I mean, Janelle Monáe is not in the kinds of scenes in this movie that Naomi Harris is in, and you can sort of, you know, see why Naomi Harris is going to be getting, you know, the credit she is, because she's, you know, really good. But, like, I love those little scenes of Janelle Monáe in the first and second sections of the movie. And sort of just, I don't know, there is something, I sort of brushed her off hearing that she was in this movie and also in Hidden Figures, because it's just sort of like that kind of, like, oh, you know, pop star wants to be in a movie. Mm-hmm.
Rihanna was in Battleship, let us not forget.
Exactly. But, like, Janelle Monáe has a presence, and, like, I'm really interested to see, you know, where she goes.
Yeah, I think she's really good in this, too. It's, like, that sort of unspoken warmth that you feel like a character is like drawing support from the person just from them being there, even if they're not actually doing
well. Something. And in a story like this, like anybody who shows any kindness, I'm just gonna go like running to like you know water in a desert and just be like, oh my god, you're so nice. He's going to be so much.
Her house is so pretty.
It is so pretty. It is. It's true.
Yeah, I really if Janelle Monáe like made up a guest bed for me, I feel like that would be like the best night's sleep of my entire life.
I agree.
So if you guys are A24, do you put all your chips behind Mahershala Ali and Naomi Harris because you know they're prominent in the early parts of the film, they're easy to remember. What do you do?
I run ads with like Heath Ledger as Ennis next to Trevante Rhodes as Chiron and go, you liked this? This is equally good.
That sounds like a Hollywood pitch meeting. If you liked this, you'll love this.
Brokeback Mountain, but in Miami.
Well, what you end up
doing
is
I would just... do that, but I would also campaign Trevante Rhodes.
Yes.
As supporting?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, he's so amazing. And I've heard, like, you know, convincing arguments like you guys made that his performance can't exist without the other two. So it's, like, almost, like, you could nominate all three of them together as lead, which breaks every rule that the Oscars have.
Yeah, right. This isn't the Tonys. Let's not get crazy.
The Billy Elliot of cinema, yeah. I think it also, I mean, the fact that supporting actor right now isn't exactly overflowing with Sure Things at this point. So, like, if they get out early on this, you could sort of, you know... establish something where it's just like, okay, well, it's the Moonlight 2 or the Moonlight 3, even if you want Andre Holland out there, you know what I mean? And then, you know, everybody else can fight for scraps, but like, it's not like they're being crowded out of a field right now, so this would be the time to, you know,
kind of... It's hard not to think they eventually will be.
Sure, but again, that's why, you know, strike while the iron's hot right now.
Yeah.
And it's a huge hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is so gratifying.
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, it's not like Sully level hit, but you know, like.
Well, I was like, going to say you could run the ads with Trevante Rhodes next to Tom Hanks and Sully and be like, you were about to vote for this. You maybe did this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be smart to campaign Trevante just because it would also remind people of the whole like trajectory of the movie. And I think any campaigns that reflect back on why the whole is greater than the sum of all the parts is also helpful in in the sordid topic of, you know, trying to get statues for your art.
Is there any, I almost am hesitant to put this out in the universe, but is there any part of you guys that sort of worries that Moonlight is going to be subject to the same kind of, like, oh, we forgot what the Academy is on Oscar nomination.
The Carolization of Moonlight?
I hesitate to say that because, as I have said for a year now, Carol got 6 nominations. It's not like they hated Carol. But, like, that, you know, Selma just got 2. You know what I mean? Like, that kind of thing where, like, we'll give you, like, Best Picture and Best Screenplay nominations, and like that's enough, right? And it's like, it's I don't think that's going to happen because Moonlight feels like a sort of a grassroots kind of a thing that is building and will have had time to build and won't have the disadvantages of timing that, you know, something like Selma had. But part of me is just sort of like, you underestimate the fustiness of this Academy at your own peril.
But they also are still reeling from Oscars So White. Like, I don't think they've forgotten about that. And Birth of a Nation kind of imploding, I think, only adds pressure to find something that proves that they don't just want to nominate white people again. So Moonlight getting kind of the treatment that Selma did, I think would be a much, much bigger deal and black mark for them. And I think at least enough of them know it.
I would hope. I was going to say, I agree with the first part of that sentence. I hope that the second part of that was also true.
I mean, I don't think, like I've said this before, and you know, people can hate on me again for it, but I really don't think the Actors Branch is anti-nominating black actors. I just think it was like unfortunate circumstances for 2 years, and since acting is so visible, people like became very focused on it. But their history doesn't show them all that resistant if they have somebody in an Oscar type, you know, performance. So I think Naomi Harris and Mahershala Ali, and then obviously like Fences is going to get acting nominations. I don't think it's going to be a problem this year. But yeah, I also,
Viola Davis at the very least can save us all.
Right. So I don't think it's going to be a problem this year, but. And I don't want to be all gross and suggest that these, you know, three movies, this and Loving, are all competing with each other, because I don't totally believe in that whole thing of, like, oh, there can only be one. I don't really think that way.
Right.
Because they're different. Right. They're different films.
Right.
They're so different.
But I think initially that's the way people talked about it before they could see the movies. Like, it was like, oh, Birth of a Nation will solve this type of thing. And I think that's like a gross way to look at it, because it's obviously like one film can't solve inherent biases or systemic problems with representation.
Part of me feels like, and I mean, the whole conversation around Birth of a Nation is much more complicated and involving, and, you know, it doesn't do anything any good to reduce it the way I'm about to slightly, but
I love these caveats.
Yeah, sorry. The implosion of Birth of a Nation, parentheses, and all that entails, in some ways was a good thing for the greater conversation, in that it didn't allow for the Academy to just sort of like put all of their, you know, shortcomings of recent onto that movie and just be like, see, fixed. Like, and the fact that that movie kind of was removed from the chessboard, now all of a sudden we, you know, have to look at everything. And there is no one solution, but now all of a sudden you look around and it's just like, oh, this actually is shaping up to be a really interesting year with a lot of really, you know, diverse movies, even within, you know, the bucket that we sometimes sort of label diversity. You know what I mean? We're like, Moonlight is so different than Loving, is so different than Fences seems to be, is so different than Hidden Figures, is so different than, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of these things.
And I think Moonlight making it through as a movie that isn't, like, you know, traditional Oscar kind of movie, like Birth of a Nation getting compared to Braveheart so much, is part of what made it seem like such a sure thing. And
yeah.
Moonlight is not really like anything else that's gone up and won Best Picture, so it kind of breaks down multiple barriers if it makes it through.
Yeah, it feels like people have really organically discovered this movie that is wowing everybody who sees it, and
yes,
it's not as though it like kind of fills a slot in the movie economy that we always see every year that people were prepared to just be bowled over by. Like, the movie's quality is so leading all the conversation around it, which is really great.
And really how we always want it to be with Oscars.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We want to be able to discover things for ourselves.
Can I also say something really reductive? I'm so...
Yes.
I'm so thrilled that, I mean, this is a horrible thing to say because you don't want to wish ill will on any movies, but I'm really kind of just so relieved that Birth of a Nation collapsed, because every single time I heard the word Braveheart, which was almost every time anybody talked about it, I was just steeling myself for the most horrible experience because I hate Braveheart so much.
Yeah.
And now I feel like maybe I don't have to see that movie.
I feel the same way. I might not have to see Birth of a Nation.
Because I don't really, like, relish seeing massacres or, like, anything that reminds me of Braveheart.
I think, I mean, to be that guy for a second, but, like, I do feel like it's an interesting failure in that it's worth seeing, you know, prioritized, you know, appropriately with everything else you need to see this fall and winter or whatever. But it's worth seeing at least eventually, just to sort of, like, see where it does fall short, because it's kind of interesting in that way, and what, you know, how this, you know, very interesting story becomes told through this lens of kind of, he's not inept, but it's a very much a first film, and it's a first film made by somebody whose instincts are a little, you know, aggrandizing in a way that I think bleeds forward onto the screen. I don't know, Nick, what did you think?
I would go further and say that you should make sure you see it in a movie theater, because I think that I see, you know, I'm not wild about it, but I think it's a pretty good movie, actually. And and Braveheart is definitely the template, so with several of the things that that implies. But to watch a movie that sort of tells racial history in this country that ends with everybody taking up their axes and saying, fuck this, is an incredibly charged thing to experience. I've actually seen it twice. And to be sitting with an audience, and withstanding everything that leads up to that third act, withstanding the third act, feeling like the movie is, you know, laid out quite a case for why this rebellion happened, but it doesn't sit totally easily with everything that's going on, and characters in the movie feel differently about it, was pretty unique, at least in my movie going experiences. And like, the more diverse the audience, the better.
Yeah, I guess it really comes down to me. It's not the racial history component. It's just I am so wary of movies that focus on and encourage bloodlust, which is what Braveheart does to me.
Yeah.
That I'm just so uncomfortable with those movies all the time. So that's why I have not wanted to see it.
Well, if this helps, there's no moment, you know, like, William Wallace is, like, making his whole career on, well, I guess that's not fair. There's so much war and there's so much battle in Braveheart that's accomplishing so many purposes for that movie, a few of which are explicitly linked to freedom, but it's pretty flimsy that that's what we're really talking about. You know, like, it just seems like it's what Mel Gibson wants to film. And I thought about Braveheart as much in the nonviolent scenes of this and the way they kind of construct Nat, the way they did Wallace, and even some of the photography. But by the time you hit violence in Birth of a Nation of that type, there's no question that it's stitched to all these difficult questions that the movie is really thinking about. So you don't feel like you're just there because the movie wants to kind of drop you in that, I would say. I don't know. I don't know if Joe feels the same way.
Well, to me, the weaknesses of the movie aren't even in that arena. Like, yeah. I feel like that's probably, I don't want to say it's the strongest parts of the movie, but it's the parts that I felt like at least feel, you know, built to and constructed to. I feel like it's the characterizations that happen in, like, the first 4/5 of that movie that sort of let me down. And the way that it sort of, you know, is almost sort of like going through those motions and not really... And just the fact that, like, I do feel like the look of it has this sort of, like, flattening kind of hue to it, and it's, I don't know, the fact that, like, all of the female characters are so, like, you know, glossed over and just sort of, like, put in place and not really addressed as people, rather than like sort of like pieces on a chessboard.
Yep.
The battles were sort of the violence of it and the sort of bloodlust of it at the end were kind of the least of my concerns by the time I left the movie.
The gender stuff is for sure totally egregious, and it doesn't require the context we all have now to see
right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That's about all the time we have. I was wondering if anybody wanted. Let's go back to Moonlight to wrap up. Any particular thing you love about it that we didn't discuss? I just want to say, I will start. The color palette was a huge wow for me.
Yeah, I agree.
I just want to talk about a shot of Andre Holland's existing gift form already, where he's just leaning against the wall of his diner and smoking and looking directly into the camera. It's it's the best use of the male gaze of the camera I think I've ever seen, and he's amazing. And according to Barry Jenkins, who I talked to on the Little Gold Men podcast, that was basically an improvised pickup after they had finished shooting. He was smoking a cigarette, and they just caught it, and it's one of my favorite parts of the film.
Wow.
Yeah, Barry Jenkins, man, he's full of good anecdotes.
God, one part.
Just something we haven't talked about, like something you loved about it.
I guess I just was so glad. This isn't one part, but just seeing a total art film and kind of hard art film aesthetic brought to this story, which I not only think that, like, Black American stories don't get filmed like Wong Kar-wai movies and Claire Denis movies, but also stories about the South never get filmed that way, mm-hmm. and or rarely, and stories about characters in this class position. So I just loved seeing this whole milieu kind of evoked with that much kind of unapologetic cinematic strategy.
Yes.
But yeah. Totally accessible at the same time. Completely. You could show this movie to anybody.
Also, I would say this movie made me go and seek out his other movie, Medicine for Melancholy, which is streaming on Netflix, if anybody wants to go watch it, is, you know, nothing like Moonlight, except for the fact that it's kind of, it's sort of very interestingly filmed and very talky, but it's very kind of sort of San Francisco hipstery milieu kind of a thing, but it's real interesting and really, like, for a movie that is essentially just sort of like Before Sunrise with Black people, it's like the conversations go to some really interesting places, and the fact that it plays around very sort of overtly with color saturation. That's sort of the big kind of idea, the capital I idea of the filmmaking of it, but it, you know, does some really interesting interesting things with it. And I would never have sought it out, even, I mean, it was an Independent Spirit Award nominee back when it came out, but I would have never really sought it out if not for the fact that Moonlight sort of brought Barry Jenkins back to the forefront, and or to the forefront, rather, not back, but happy for that.
All right, so you have four huge thumbs up for Moonlight, and we assume Charlie loves it too.
Oh yeah, he hasn't seen it yet, but when we get the screener, maybe we'll just put it on a loop until he maybe his first word will be Chiron. I don't know.
That seems like a complicated first word.
It's also a lot to introduce a kid to. You might start with Looney Tunes and then work our way up to it.
Right. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. It was so good to hear your voices again.
I know. I'm so glad.
So everybody go see Moonlight. It expanded this weekend, and next weekend it hits even more theaters. So
yeah.
It's expanding quickly because the response has been big.
Be a part of this success. You will be happy to.
Yeah.
It's almost as though not releasing it at Christmas or Thanksgiving was a really good idea.
Imagine it.